Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How are North Texans coping with tough times, and who is there to help? This year's economy is swelling the ranks of clients at aid organizations, which are working overtime to balance growing need with tightening budgets. My guests today are intimately familiar with how those challenges affect their organizations and the real people who count on them. Larry James is president and CEO of Central Dallas Ministries. Mike Doyle is CEO of the Fort Worth-based Cornerstone Assistance Network. Larry, Mike, welcome to Think.
Good to be here.
Maybe you can tell us how things are different in terms of demand for you as compared with a year ago.
We saw the increase in January. As a matter of fact, in the first quarter of 2008, our demand for services were up almost 45%. It's leveled off, and the average is about 30% over the course of the year. So we saw it coming early, and it's been dramatic.
We do the same thing. We've seen, since March or so, tremendous new needs arise that we haven't seen come before, and have had to either slow down what we were able to provide for those that are in need, or find additional resources to help fill the gap between the end of the year. We actually did find some additional resources, and it was anticipated that we would run out of those resources in September of this year had we not found and replaced those. But a local foundation actually here in Dallas stepped up and helped us do that, and so we're back on track. But we're going to see about a 40-50% increase in need from over last year.
So it sounds like you've also seen a shift in the people and organizations that support your own.
Yes, we have. We have just in the North Texas area, really all over Texas, we are so blessed to have foundations that understand the issues of people that are coming to organizations like Larry's and ours that will step up to the plate and say, hey, we've got a little extra money. How can we best use it? We're just really fortunate to have that along with the individuals in our community that are very philanthropic.
You know, for the first time in a long time, we're seeing middle-class folk, maybe at the bottom of the middle-class strata, dropping in to see us. I told someone not long ago that as we talk about the possibility of a depression, no one wants to use the D word. I've been working with people for 15 years who know intimately what a depression feels like, because there's some very, very low-income people in Dallas County living on $10,000 a year and less, and that's depression income. But now what we're seeing is an increase in middle-class folks coming to us with mortgage problems, transportation problems, health care problems, loss of insurance, all sorts of things that go along with this recession, and that's driving our numbers.
And I guess the other important thing to remember is that just because people who've been unemployed then find work, their problems don't disappear with the first paycheck. There's a recovery period.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And often a wage problem, because maybe I've lost a job 6 months ago. I land the job, maybe with the help of Mike's agency or his training or whatever, and it might be that maybe my wages are 30% less than they were before, or more in some cases.
I know that both of your organizations really focus a lot on helping people to help themselves and to take sort of an active role in their own well-being. How do you do that when it's hard for people with top job skills to find work, and it's hard for people to even maintain the incomes that they've had in the best of times?
It's a difficult process. You have to almost reorient them to the fact that while you're not going to make the income that you did, you are going to make some income, and some is better than none. They see their savings and their 401ks and everything else going down drastically anyway. And so for some folks, it is about a 15-year step back in their careers, in the income levels that they're now making versus what they were making. So we give them the opportunity to have additional job training in areas that they haven't done before that may not be something that they used in their previous job, but that is needed in the local economy today. And a lot of it is around technology and how technology can be a booster to move them back up the corporate ladder when they were there at one point and got laid off and having to start again.
I wonder about personal contributions, not so much from organizations, but from individuals who may have supported both of you in the past. in America, and maybe this is a fortunate thing, every one of us can always point to someone who is doing better than we are. And we can say, well, they're doing very well, but I'm not doing so well. And I wonder if we need to step back and sort of reevaluate our ability to give, because it seems like there may be a lot of people who are in a position to make a difference, but they just don't perceive that there's anything extra.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an issue for sure. I also think that sometimes people who want to give are not familiar with the opportunities. Mm-hmm. And there's also a confidence factor. I want my money to count. I care. But how do I give in the most effective manner to help the most? And that's where I think we've got to do a better job of getting our story out, as well as promoting the stories of our colleagues. This is not competition. This is we have an opportunity to build a community in the philanthropic world that aligns resources rather than siloing them, so we get the most out of what we have. But, you know, as the needs have grown for us this year, we've had a lot of donors. As Mike mentioned, he mentioned the foundations. I would add that we've had a lot of individuals step forward as never before. Mm-hmm. And they are, many of them, stepping forward in a time of great uncertainty personally. They don't have assurances that next year is going to be very good for them either, but they have a heart for people that are suffering and hurting. And so it's been very gratifying watching that. The other thing that happens in our center, and I know it probably happens in yours as well, Mike, the new people who come need more than groceries and food and health care and transportation. They need human connection. Mm-hmm. They need encouragement. And it's interesting, in our shop, we have very low-income people who work every day in our resource center, and they've been doing it for years. And when these new folks come to our place, it's interesting to watch very poor people encourage people who are dropping off out of the middle class. And so there is a spiritual dimension of this, not a little less. You know, I'm not promoting any particular religion necessarily with this comment, but it's just a kind of human connection that buoys the spirit and helps with the personal worldview, I guess, of people who are in difficult circumstances.
Yeah, that whole relationship thing is very, very important. We're seeing it all over the place, where more and more of our donors and volunteers are wanting to mentor other families, and that is so important for somebody who's in desperate needs, physically, emotionally, financially, because they need somebody to talk to. And they've typically been sheltered from or excluded from their families and their friends. And when they can you loan me some money? Can you give me a place to stay? That seems to isolate a lot of what we would think were friends that may not have truly been friends, and even families. So they need, as Larry said, that human contact, that mentor, that even if they come down to the food bank like Larry's and volunteer and get around people, they begin to feel better, and then you restore some hope. But on his comment about the donors, our individual donors have not dropped in this economic uncertainty. We're seeing it increase. It's the corporate folks that seem to be putting off till next year until they can determine what the economy is going to do. But we think it's a real opportunity for those individuals to step up to the plate like they always have, because we're so philanthropic here in North Texas.
Larry, you mentioned earlier people dropping off out of the middle class. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that some of the first people to be really affected by this are children. When mm-hmm. a family falls into poverty, what changes in the life of the child whose parents had adequate resources and suddenly don't?
In many cases, there's a loss of the family's insurance policy. There's the whole psychological reality of what home's like now, mm-hmm. when families on edge are very challenged. The conflict in marriages, the lack of resources, they go so far in some cases as not being able to really stretch across the month to provide adequate food mm-hmm. for a family. I mean, it's amazing the number of people who are a paycheck or two away from a situation of dire circumstance. And the credit crisis that affects individual consumers, I think, is evidence of how fragile our economy has been for a long time, and we just haven't known it.
You could borrow the money until you could get past it before.
Precisely. And you know, the President-elect Obama mentioned in a recent speech that I heard that we anticipate 9 million new Americans falling below the poverty line. That's staggering.
Staggering.
And when you think about what that means for organizations like yours and mine, what it means for states, what it means for programs like Children's Health Insurance Program, and how that needs to be fully funded, fully funding that going forward is going to be much different than it would have been, say, 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So children are very vulnerable in these kinds of times, and it's a real challenge.
And additionally, you see parents taking second jobs. You see moms maybe going to work who hadn't worked before, and so right. just the sheer point of the parents not being there as often, and the kids now being with the sitter when they've never been with the sitter before, or they have now got to move to a smaller house because they're losing theirs, and they move away from their relationship base again. And this relationship is just key, that we've just got to keep that relationship of family and friends together so that they don't lose hope. Because when you uproot a child, particularly a homeless child, and we see this in the homeless kids a lot, they may be in four different school districts, in four different schools, in 6 different months. So it's when you start moving around and you can never build roots, it's difficult. And we're seeing some of the kids today, as a result of the economic downturn and loss of jobs, that are just wondering where mommy and daddy are now.
And you know, there's another factor here, and that's pressure on the bottom. As people drop into the category of poor or below the poverty line, more skilled than some of the folks we've been dealing with, mm-hmm. there's pressure downward that presses those at the bottom down further, because as jobs are acquired by middle class folks who are having difficulty, those jobs can't be acquired by the people we've been working with.
Right.
And so we're seeing kind of a growing sort of despair and malaise beneath this new strata of folks falling into the category. So it's a challenging time mm-hmm. for organizations like ours, and also for our neighbors in the communities where we live and work.
One analysis that I read of the problems of poverty in Texas pointed to a lot of siloing between among local governments. You have to go here to get this service and there to get that service. Is there a way? I know we have the Council of Governments. We have organizations that try to sort of bring everyone together. Is there a strategy that we're not utilizing that might make things better?
That's a great question. I think we see occasions when people do come together, and normally it's around something large and systemic, like, for example, Parkland Health and Hospital System, or the Bridge downtown Dallas, the new Homeless Assistance Center, where city and county and local philanthropy come together to really come out of the silo and make something work. But in terms of a broad strategy that sort of encompasses the community, we don't have that, and probably we need to think through what that would mean. What kind of political will do we need to create that kind of superstructure to coordinate everything in a better way? The way our government is here with city, county, state, and so many local municipalities, it's really challenging. You know, you think about Dallas County and all the different cities that are in Dallas County, and the poor are everywhere, mm-hmm. and the numbers are growing everywhere. As a matter of fact, many of these new folk we've been talking about are in suburban communities.
Yeah,
and so it's a challenge. But what you're suggesting is a good suggestion. It's just complicated.
Do we have an opportunity in this crisis, as horrible as it is, to maybe alleviate some of the judgment that has fallen on lower income people in this country for a long time? The assumption that they're poor because of some essential character flaw.
Oh, absolutely. When you start to join them, they become a lot less
more sympathetic.
Yes, and that's happening. It's happening a lot. And I think the folks that when they move from the middle income down into the lower income, lower poverty levels, they meet folks down there that they didn't ever dream they would meet. But I think that's good for us. I think that gives us the empathy and the compassion that we need for those folks, and we see them in an entire different light. Not everybody that's homeless is the guy on the side of the street laying there drunk. I mean, that's just a very, very small percentage of the homeless population in both Dallas and Fort Worth. There's a lot of folks that are out there working, trying to make it get back on their feet through domestic violence or loss of income or those kind of things, that are homeless and in transitional programs. And so once you get intimately familiar with the folks that you are now classified with, you have a new respect for what they do and what they go through.
What do you say to people who really want to help but may not feel like their financial resources would be enough to make a difference? Are there a lot of volunteer opportunities? Do you recommend people simply just find someone in their own neighborhood and try to do something right?
Some of both, I think, mm-hmm. and maybe some more. There are volunteer opportunities in our organizations and in other organizations. Being a good neighbor where you are is a mighty fine thing to do, mm-hmm. and just being with a sensitivity and openness to other people who are in difficulty.
How do we spot those people? Because sometimes it's if hard. Our neighbors, they don't want us to know they're in trouble.
Well, with the garage doors that close into the alleys, and you go in, you don't see each other. We don't have front porches anymore, and so it's more of a challenge. But through PTAs, through civic associations, through schools, through churches, there are ways to get engaged. I also would go back to the power of the small gift. $10 a month is $120 a year, and $120, the way we do food delivery, provides many, 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 many meals. Mm-hmm. It provides a lot of services for children after school, and so the size of the gift is not so much the important thing as the engagement of the heart in the process. And good things happen when that happens.
And if someone runs across someone who obviously is in need, and you can tell, even if your neighbor doesn't want you to know, you can tell when the activity is going on, and you know, just being able to walk over and say, just wanted to encourage you, everything okay, mm-hmm. and haven't seen you out in the yard lately, or those kind of things, and then you begin to think, okay, if you needed help, where would I go? And you can just call organizations like Central Dallas Ministries or Cornerstone Assistance Network, and if we're not doing what that person needs, there certainly is, there are organizations we know of that will, and you just begin to understand where the resources are. There's also a 211 Texas hotline.
To get help.
And all you do is call 211 and tell them what your issue is, and they'll say, here's the agencies around you that help.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Just ahead on Think, an award-winning short video revives the glories of the Million Dollar Monarch. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seat calendar for this weekend features musical interludes, bump and grind, and a festive fairy tale. The Eisman Center plays host to Tooser Ballet's 24th annual production of the perennial holiday favorite and the longest-running Metroplex production of The Nutcracker, featuring Leaping Cossacks, The Sugar Plum Fairy, and plenty of Yuletide cheer. Mixing the Tchaikovsky classic with a bit of bump and grind, MBS Productions offers up the Beulahville Baptist Book Club Presents a Burlesque Nutcracker at the Stone Cottage Theater in Addison. The Old Red Museum of Dallas County invites you out for the first annual Deck the Halls at Old Red exhibit, showcasing the holiday traditions of 18 Dallas County nonprofits. And if you're up for some musical comfort and joy, come out for what MSNBC calls one of the top 10 holiday concerts in America, as the DSO pulls out all the stops for their annual Stories of Christmas concerts, wrapping up this weekend at the Meyerson. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
For our Seat segment today, a very unusual sort of historical profile. KERA executive producer Rob Tranchin introduces us to the Million Dollar Monarch.
There's a pecan tree near Preston Road and Armstrong Parkway that's been here nearly as long as Dallas itself. In 1865, Joseph Cole was working his cornfield north of town when he came upon this tree, no bigger round than a pencil, sprouting from the earth. The shoot had grown from a pecan carried up from nearby Turtle Creek, perhaps dropped by a bird or squirrel. The tree was too far from the creek to survive, and most farmers would have plowed it under, but Joe ordered a field hand to fence the tree off and water it. Joe had just come home from the Civil War, and later, people would explain what he did by saying he'd seen too much destruction and killing up north. Of course, nobody really knows why Joe did what he did, but the tree survived, and Joe took care of it until it could be seen for miles on the flat plain above the creek, just off the Preston Trail. Eventually, the land was sold, and Joe died. Some said that Joe had placed a deed restriction on the land, protecting the tree. But the story proved to be false. As it turned out, he didn't have to. In the 1920s, developers envisioned the town of Highland Park on the land that had once grown Joseph Cole's corn. At the time, it was said that the developers were offered $1 million for a lot that would include the pecan tree. Perhaps that story wasn't true either, but in any case, the tree was not for sale. Instead, the pecan was given its own parkway, a place of honor at the entrance to town. And because of the story, it became known as the Million Dollar Monarch. Decorating the tree at Christmas became an annual tradition. In time, the houses around the tree would become worth $1 million, then much more. Fewer people noticed the tree or remembered its name. But there are those who think of the history Joe Cole's pecan tree has seen. And those who know the story of the Million Dollar Monarch think of Joe Cole and of what remains after we're gone.
Thanks again to Rob Tranchin, who shot and produced the Emmy Award-winning piece you just saw. David Alvarado edited, and Tom Pribble created the graphics. To access our free podcast, you can go to the Think page of KERA's website. Our email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.